Who can say where the killer roams? When the blood flows, it's slaying time. Slay away. Slay away. Slay away.
Behind your favorite horror films, lore, gore, and every kill in between. On this episode, we'll be discussing the film that was my introduction to horror at the tender age of 5 in my grandmother's living room. That's right, it's Stephen King's Silver Bullet. Today, we are talking about all things werewolves and creature features based on Stephen King's novella, Cycle of the Werewolf, published in 1983 and adapted to a screenplay by King. Silver Bullet was directed by Daniel Attias and released on October 11th, 1985. The film was produced by Dino De Laurentiis and is now considered a cult classic. In a small town, brutal killings start to plague the close-knit community. Marty Coslaw, a paraplegic boy, is convinced the murders are being perpetrated by a werewolf.
It began in May. And every month after that, whenever the moon was full, it happened again. And again.
What was that?
It's over there.
Don't point that at me.
Nobody knew who or what was responsible.
Come on.
They only knew it had to be stopped. Now, from the master of mystery and suspense, Stephen King's Silver Bullet.
Silver Bullet today. I'm super excited. It's one of the first horror films that I ever saw, and I've got Heather Buckley here with me to talk about it. So, Heather, are you ready to chat about all things horror and werewolves with me today?
I am. I feel very close to the werewolf milieu, and I think Silver Bullet is the best adaptation of King. And I will go on record today, and have I gone on record before, that this is true. I also have thoughts that back that up. Critical thinking about why, because I'm also a Stephen King fan. I've read the text, so I'm familiar with his text and his style, which is why I'm making this proclamation.
Okay, well, I believe it. That's no better source for the truth on Stephen King adaptations than Heather Buckley today. So I wanted to ask you about how you discovered your love of horror and what you consider your role within the horror community to be.
So when I was growing up, I was very scared of rubber masks and Halloween and horror. I was a free roaming horror kid. Some are like that, who like going to the den or like their parents' room where they're watching television and come across horrific gore, horror, monster stuff, and either they love it or they hate it. So my father was a huge horror fan. I didn't know that at the time because I was very little. And I remember Poltergeist was on, where the guy's like ripping off his face, like the mystery meat scene. And then the sort of the end of the Cronenberg's The Fly, and just walking in and having such like a traumatic response to such intense imagery. And then I would sort of like go outside and sort of like try to like find myself. I remember once like running to my grandfather from watching the scene from Poltergeist that was on TV. So that's an early recollection of horror, and it's an effect on me.
Yeah, it's one of the most traumatic scenes in that film, also, with the steak moving across the kitchen counter and then him in the bathroom.
In the middle of the day in Central Jersey. And then there was the book Night Shift, the original paperback with the hand with the eyes, which I find hand and eyes very creepy. It was like a scene in the movie The Gate. And I would go upstairs and I would look at this Stephen King novel and I would look at it and it would scare me and I'd run away and I'd look at it again. So we've watched intense imagery by mistake in the den. I've seen intense imagery sort of laying around, and then I was very interested in it. Growing up as sort of like an outsider kid, I was friends with a whole bunch of metalheads, and this had to be like middle school. And they would pass around Cracked Monster Party, which I loved. Yeah, I came to love, and they would always talk about horror movies. And they were like, Heather, could you please just, they're not scary. Just watch horror movies so we can talk about them. And so it's like, so I gave it a shot. So at this time, Central Jersey kid, outsider kid, have not discovered punk just yet, but definitely a weirdo. I watched Friday the 13th Part 5, and my deep identification with Jason Voorhees, because I have been bullied and tortured by the kid so much, I went, this is incredible. I feel like Jason. I like this medium. And that is actually how that happened. So my love of the genre is the love of its focus on otherness and dark imagery and things that feel like my home. I mean, my home is filled with holy death icons and taxidermy and horror movies and strange art and stuff like that. So I always felt it was a celebration of that, celebration of the leather faces, the Jasons, the Jigsaws that I felt very close to.
I feel like our homes should get together because they'd probably get along.
They could get married.
Very similar. There's lots of dead things all over the place. And I started doing some stuff with taxidermy.
I have my taxidermy mouse. Just
entomology, bugs. There's all kinds of stuff. And
I like it. It's our creature nature.
Yeah. I don't know what it is about this film that really ignited my love of creature features as well and my exploration into that. Probably around the ages, between the ages of like 5 to 7, I want to say. So give me the high-level overview of why you love Silver Bullet.
So I feel when you rank Stephen King films, what is the most Stephen King and what is the sort of like less Stephen King? I feel the more Stephen King you take from a film like The Shining, you almost in a way start going into a high art space because the stuff that you're really taking away is his language, is his sort of like... And I think it's a lot of his language because he uses very regional slang in his work, and it could be considered, you know, a little goofy. And so you have a movie like The Shining where you're taking Stephen King's idea, and Kubrick is making sort of this high art film. And so when you're watching Carrie, a lot of that language is removed. A lot of it, like this sort of, I don't want to say rural because I'm not very familiar with like what's up in Maine, but just sort of like that local language. And Silver Bullet maintains not only sort of like that local town Norman Rockwell sort of feel, but it sort of retains the characters and the language that is in Stephen King's book. And that kind of silly language. I wanted to once, with my writing partner, Ethan, find every single like silly rural phrase in his books and just make a whole compilation of his crazy slang and stuff that his people say that are ridiculous. And for some reason, filmmakers don't believe that they can translate it, and they sort of remove a lot of that from the material. Silver Bullet doesn't do that. Silver Bullet, we're in a rural town. People have people speak in this sort of slang. You have sort of like the characterizations that you've seen in the Stephen King universe, which are kind of like blue collar dudes. And that was what I feel makes Silver Bullet very Stephen King, because it keeps that language. But by keeping that language, if you can't sell it, I think it's a lot of times it's like a razor's edge to like, how do I use King's language, King's sort of original language, and not have it sound in a certain way and have it found cinematic. So that's actually the part that brings Silver Bullet like back as something like as compared to like Kubrick's The Shining, when we're talking about like high cinema aesthetics and things like that. I think there could be a take of Silver Bullet that's more like Schrader's Blue Collar, because there should be a way to retain his language that's in the text and sort of focus on these sort of characters without removing it to sort of like, and I'm using elevated in quotes to sort of elevate it, because I think it's part of King's writing for these type of groups of people, like the local locals. I think it's what sort of makes his, it creates an authenticity of his work, because that's sort of his lived reality of the folks in his community.
Right. And there's a lot of interesting scrutiny when it comes to this film that I mostly disagree with. So, and I don't know why, but for me, I don't find a ton of flaws with the film itself. The ending narration dialogue is a little funny.
It makes me,
when the film closes.
I'm trying to think, because I'm going back to all the Stephen King stuff. It really has, and because people have said that Dead Zone, like, that's very Norman Rockwell, and it isn't in its aesthetic, but it is too cold a bit to really feel like Americana. And I think Silver Bullet captures Americana when it comes to like what that town looks like, how everybody interacts outside of sort of the locals, the kind of like narration and storytelling ending. I mean, it's something that I feel, though more period piece, Something Wicked This Way Comes feels like.
Yeah, you could see this as a town that has an industry and like the train line running through it, right? We see that with the opening in the film. And it's one of those small towns that relies on certain industry, that if that industry were to up and leave that town, the town would probably die.
Yes.
And that kind of gives it that blue collar feel to
Yes.
Me.
Yes. And again, like Americana, which I believe movies like Texas Chainsaw Massacre has as well. And so I feel like I'm in this place, and there's sort of like a gentleness about it, which is an interesting contrast to the werewolf and the gore, but it makes a lot of sense, because it's also kind of like what Blue Velvet's saying, that sort of like in these little towns are these horrible secrets, and especially very political, using religion and the werewolf. It's a very interesting critique as well. So we're not like in an Americana, much like Chainsaw, that it's like, oh, how great the old days. You know, I think there is a progressive message in Silver Bullet a bit.
Jumping into an introduction of the film, but the film is based on Stephen King's novella, Cycle of the Werewolf. And Silver Bullet, it's really kind of a pulpy, bloody monster story. There's some good humor, likable, relatable characters that you might find it's, you know, your next door neighbor, etc. And there's no shortage of small town private justice, which there's a really great speech about private justice in this film, when the town is sort of rallying around each other once essentially whoever's committing these murders sort of in their mind has really just gone too far, because there's the murder of a child. So but it's been reported that Cycle of the Werewolf began as a horror calendar idea. So King was approached by Chris Zavizza with the idea to create a horror calendar. And this was quite a while back. And so he was inclined to do that. And there was an interesting kind of story about it from the Stephen King Companion, that he was inclined because he felt a lot of guilt, apparently. He was one of the authors or special guests at the 1979 World Fantasy Convention, and he was really excited to be among lots of great genre writers at the time. And apparently he felt quite a bit of shame about how much more successful he was at the time than they were. So he evidently felt that he owed a debt to their creative genius and was going to, you know, make this cycle of the werewolf sort of horror calendar to, I don't know, repay that debt and the path that they paved for his career. So Cycle of the Werewolf itself didn't become a horror calendar. It was published as a limited edition hardcover in 1983 and reprinted as a mass market paperback 2 years later. So then released about 4 years after John Landis's An American Werewolf in London and Joe Dante's The Howling, Silver Bullet. It's not precisely remembered as one of the truly great werewolf films of the 1980s, but I believe that it should be. It is one of my favorites and the first horror film that I remember watching. So it holds a really special place in my heart as the film that really began my foray into horror and my love of creature features, as I mentioned to you before, Heather. So in the film, it's interesting because the character of Jane Coslaw serves as the narrator of the film, as well as the older sister of the main protagonist in the movie. And that's Marty. And their relationship is really rocky. So that is kind of a through line in the film as well. And the relationship changes after a series of murders in this small, it really is a rural town, Tarker's Mills, Maine. And it starts in the spring of 1976. My guess, even though they don't specifically say what month it is that it starts just before like maybe the end of April, to account for the timeline in the film that people talk about all the time. So one of my favorite things about the film is that it has this really great othered representation. The character of Marty, played by Corey Haim, is a disabled kid who really, against all odds, with the help of his sister Jane, played by Megan Follows, and Uncle Red, played by Gary Busey, saves, you know, his sleepy town from a werewolf. And I really uniquely identified with Marty's feelings of being othered by society, unable to connect with the world like everyone else. Like personally, I have and deal with double deficit dyslexia, autism spectrum disorder, and I was sexually abused as a child. So Silver Bullet was an escape from the isolation and the stress and the shame and the fear and the anxiety that I felt when I was a kid. And it really helped me to cope with situations and emotions that I didn't understand yet. So it's a big movie for me, and it brings a lot of that up every time that I watch it. But yet at the same time, there's a catharsis through that experience. But at the time that I first screened the film on television, I think it was thanks to my grandmother's constant perusing of TV Guide between like 1989 to 1991. And I was really also questioning being raised in the Christian faith. I went to a private Christian school in my very early education days. And I found that the well-mannered monster of Reverend Lester Lowe, played by Everett McGill, and his double nature really fascinating. And Regina Chavez Muir describes him best in her essay Of Manners and Monsters, The Lawlessness of Stephen King's Reverend Lester Lowe. And she says that exacting penance on the townspeople of Tarker's Mills, Lester Lowe explains to Marty that he killed one woman because she was contemplating suicide. During that killing, he smashed through the woman's second floor bedroom window and tore her apart. It's a very deliberate killing, not at all the kind of killing seen in other films where the victims find themselves in these dark streets or woods. The werewolf uses his humanity to fuel his killings in Silver Bullet. So unlike like American Werewolf in London, maybe a little bit to what's going on in The Howling, but at least in American Werewolf in London, these aren't intentional like murders that happen with the werewolf. So, but here we see something very different from that. And there's a lot of themes explored that nobody really talks about.
I just think from what you just said, it's like, my God, this film is it aligns so deeply for you. So many levels. Now, did you Because it is nice to see the Marty character as someone who's disabled, but also physically disabled, because I feel we don't see that a lot in films. Someone in a wheelchair, usually the disability is more invisible or very, very visible. So is that sort of where your heart was with Marty? Also, that the disabled person is not only the focus of the film, but also heroic and uses the chair to obliterate the evil. Now, of course, like I'm always on the side of like werewolves and creatures and stuff like that. But I'd love to hear you talk more about Marty's heroism and you.
I think that with Marty, it sort of showcases that. It's like what Red says. At a point, Red says to Marty's mother that he's not at a disadvantage. She's talking to him about all these disadvantages that Marty already has in place because of his disability. And Red says, no, that's not true. You treat him that way, and that's how his life is going to be.
It's very prophetic.
And yeah, it was really interesting because it's when they're basically, he's sleeping on the couch. He's drinking that bottle of Wild Turkey. And, you know, she's sort of seeing him as like, don't show Marty what a loser looks like and how to give up, right? He's talking to her about, well, you've given up on him because he has this disability. So you treat him differently because you sort of assume the world's going to treat him this way. So you're treating him this way and you're not allowing him to sort of transcend what you think he's capable of. Put it that way. I thought that was really interesting. It's just something that sort of lies in there. It's one scene. It's not something that comes up really ever again throughout the film. But if you're watching and you notice it, it's great that that's sort of who the Uncle Red character is someone who believes that Marty can really do anything. And Marty takes that influence and I think believes enough in himself with the help of Jane and Red to sort of overcome obstacles that other people don't think that he's capable of.
Well, it's also because Uncle Red is an outsider himself.
Yeah.
I think that's well, it's sort of like the cool uncle or the cool teacher who sees that special thing in you because they're a little off as well. Off in the best way.
Off in the best way, yeah.
Yes.
Well, I have to say, so Regina went on to say that although the Reverend hunts Marty with an almost fervent pleasure, there is evidence in the film that he is afraid of the wolf inside of him. And I think we see that in the dream sequence more than any other time. But there is a moment when he wakes up from the dream. He's drenched in sweat and he's terrified. And in the dream, there's this entire congregation that turns into werewolves while he's talking once again about, can I offer you any words of comfort? You know, so he's like horrified. He wakes up. He starts praying. Let it end, dear God, let it end. And I think that's really interesting. And he also tries to warn the town hunters about looking for the killer on a full moon night and tries to stop them. So I just want to take a moment to have us sort of listen to this scene.
It's hard at a time like this to find the words to offer you any comfort.
There is no comfort. There is only private justice.
The Bible tells us not to fear the terror that creepeth by night, or that which flieth by noonday. And yet we do. We do. Because there's so much we don't know, and we feel very small.
Reverend, he was torn apart! Dear God, let it end.
And tragically, of course, they don't listen or heed his warning, and we end up with four more bodies. And it's from that dream sequence that that's like a really cool scene. And no one talks about how amazing the practical effects are in this film. And even the score, which if I'm looking here, was done by Jay Chataway. That you get that small town feel from the score too. A little bit.
You do.
There's this kind of magical other world about small towns that comes through in the music.
Yes. And it just seems we're so hovering around like that. That's our affection for it. I mean, you have very personal interest in it. But for me, it's like being part of that small town. Because as a Stephen King fan, you get to hang out in a real Stephen King town. And as I've mentioned, I can't think of any other films that really capture a Stephen King town, that you're there for a bit hanging out with its folks.
I feel like this is almost the most we see of a Stephen King town, other than the newer adaptations, or maybe the original adaptation of It.
Yes. I'm going back to the 90s and going like, I
just rewatched the miniseries because I was like, you know, it's about time.
It's true.
Is Tim Curry still going to scare me as much as he did when I was a kid?
Were you scared?
I think he was still really scary. One of the things that got me with the It miniseries, it was because I was always super anti-spider. And I think I still am. So that's, even though it looks a little goofy now, I still don't like it. With regards to Lo, Regina continues and says that, like, the glimpses of humanity are shown, but it's Marty's bottle rocket to the eye that exposes Lo as the werewolf. And after this, what was left of his humanity is gone, and he targets Marty and grows angrier, waiting for the right moment to strike. So Reverend Lo and the werewolf have become the same being with the same goals, and they're, you know, the rules no longer apply. They fly out the window. So I wanted to get your thoughts on Reverend Lo and, you know, just the duality of his personality and what he represents in the film, because there's a lot of interesting moments in the film that have to do with religion. And I haven't seen a lot of people talk about that either, in sort of religious persecution of otherness at the same time, and sort of he's hiding his identity behind that mask as well.
there's so many different reads on it. I mean, because I grew up Catholic, and so as we know how the priests are sort of hiding their nature of what they do to children, and then the church itself taking away people's rights. And so there's a duality there right away, and how you're always trying to hide your other, but not very, very positive nature. But I feel because for me specifically, when you bring the otherness into like creaturedom or monsters, it depends on your gaze, whether you feel that's evil or not evil. Because he's a werewolf, which is pretty awesome. And the idea that he's hiding his werewolf nature. There's the metaphor of the wolf in the flock, of course. And if we take Stephen King's idea of the wolf in the flock, is that the death leading them astray, questioning the leadership or religious leadership because you don't know who this person really is. But there's something to me, you know, I love the Reverend because he's a monster. And sometimes monsters have these crazy jobs. Sometimes they're your minister, and sometimes they don't get the metaphor. Sometimes in your small repressive town, you have someone that has like this very, in my mind, very special secret of being an other, the most other that you could be, because it's you start moving away from your humanity into a place of sort of like otherness and inhumanity and creaturedom, which is very, that's why my affection would be with the Reverend.
And I also love Reverend Lowe. I love Reverend Lowe, and I feel like we don't know how he became a werewolf. We don't know how long he's been a werewolf at the, you know, at the time we see this character. We don't know how long he's been a part of this community. We don't know if he became a reverend as some sort of penance for his otherness and being a creature, right? There's a lot of questions.
That would be an incredible backstory. I would feel that my fanfic is sort of in that area.
Yeah. I think that he is a really, I don't personally see him as a you know, black and white good character or evil character. It's not as simple as that, I think, with Reverend Lowe. The only time when that gets a little confusing is his speech to Marty in the rundown bridge.
Marty. I'm very sorry about this, Marty. I don't know if you believe that or not, but it's true. I would never willingly hurt a child.
Please. I won't tell anyone.
You should have left me alone, Marty. I can't kill myself. Our religion teaches that suicide is the greatest sin a man or a woman can commit. Stella was going to commit suicide, and if she had done so, she would be burning in hell right now. By killing her, I took her physical life, but I saved her life eternal. You see how all things serve the will and the mind of God. You see? You meddling little shit! You're gonna have a terrible accident, Marty. You're gonna fall in the river.
When he makes the little speech about Stella and why, the justification for why he killed her, he does this big Bible quote thing that then feels a little odd and like religion is the sword, if that makes sense.
Yes. Well, I mean,
it felt very out of place, I would say, for his character throughout the rest of the film.
I think part of it is the struggle of justification of what we are and what we're doing. It's hard to accept. I mean, it would be hard to accept a monster identity in that space, right? Of this small town. And so that we use also, I mean, if we go back to the original metaphor, which is a more traditional metaphor, you know, religion is evil, you know, wolf in sheep's clothing with the flock, is that how we're sort of using the language of religion to justify atrocities and murder and pain. So I think that he could be playing two sides, right? So there's the creature that the other creature, the werewolf creature, and how we sort of see him and his struggles, but also as a creature and as a part human, that he it falls trapped to trying to find excuses within religious texts to justify what he has done. Which also means that he's very tortured by what he's done if he's going to the text to figure out what's going on. Unlike our werewolves and howling, who would never reference anything and just go, hear that further part of, I'm just a fucking monster. I mean, that's what Eddie the werewolf feels like. I'm just a monster.
He's not even really trying to provide a justification. It comes across as like very zealous gloating. I did this because what she was doing was wrong, and you know, Unwed mother about to commit suicide. In his mind, I saved her from the bowels of hell because suicides go to hell. In his mind, he's delivered her from an eternity of pain and suffering.
It's a very Travis Bickle moment.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, so as far as the production of the film, what I found a couple interesting tidbits. The appearance of the werewolf, I think, is worth discussing. Now, it's been talked about a lot, especially by film critics. And at the time of the film's release, the werewolf's bear-like appearance got a lot of poor remarks from critics, with one stating that it looks less like a wolf than a smoky bear with a terrible hangover, which I'm like, I mean, I get the bear references, but not necessarily Smokey Bear with a hangover, but that's just my opinion. So as it turns out, King had asked for the werewolf to be plain and hard to see, in contrast to the hulking monsters seen in other werewolf films and books in the early to mid 1980s, with the end result being a creature that looked more like a black bear than anything else and did not really have any identifying characteristics. So after seeing Carlo Rambaldi's design for King's request, producer Dino De Laurentiis was very unhappy and demanded a change. He was very unhappy and demanded many changes throughout the filming of this movie. So both King and Rambaldi refused to change the design. It's what they wanted. So eventually, pre-production fell behind schedule, and the project's original director, Don Coscarelli, opted to start filming the non-werewolf scenes without knowing what was going to happen with this werewolf suit that they were making. So after they completed the non-werewolf scenes, not having any clear picture about what would happen with the film, Coscarelli resigned as the director, and that's when Dan Attias came in. So when pressured to either cancel the film or accept the design, De Laurentiis relented and allowed filming to continue with Rimaldi's original werewolf suit design that King had approved. So it's the vision that King wanted, and I'm all here for it. So there was also a modern dance actor hired to perform the stunts inside the suit, but De Laurentiis didn't like his performance either. So eventually what happened is that Everett McGill, who plays Reverend Lowe in human form, wound up acting most of the scenes out in the werewolf suit as well. So he's credited with the dual role. But I wanted to get your thoughts. If you can recall, I don't know if you're going to be able to recall this film's been out for a while. So if can you recall your initial reaction to the creature design, and what are your thoughts on it now?
I think that it's hard to nail a werewolf because I think that's also why we don't see a lot of werewolf films out in Gen Pop at the moment. I mean, it's one reason I love the Reverend is because it's Everett McGill. And how can you not love the character that Everett McGill played? And for the Blu-ray that's out there in the world, we were able to locate the ubiquitous Everett McGill, and I interviewed him about his entire career, including this movie. How the hiring of him happened was that because of Quest for Fire and his movements and his ability to sort of wear a lot of makeup, and how he can emote through the makeup, is how he got that role and why they wanted him to play always both the man and the wolf. I don't mind the werewolf. There's been worse werewolves out there in the world.
Yeah, I actually always thought it was really scary, and it felt realistic to me as a child. And even now looking at it, especially because I'm just always in awe of these really beautiful uses of it and the way that it was filmed, when sometimes it was just a hand or just the legs or just the face. There was a lot of mystery involved. Still.
And it's also suit monster work. I mean, we don't look at Creature of the Black Lagoon and go like, oh, that looks like a guy in a costume, or it's right. Very silly. Because even the werewolves and the howling are puppets to sort of get that form. The end werewolf in American Werewolf in London is animatronic. All the wolf men are just like, I put fuzzy things on your face and now you're a wolf man. You know, it's much more subtle. But this is like werewolf design. So this is the full wolf, and you're getting a performance of an incredible actor in that costume. I mean, a lot of and then you could critique well, it's overlit, because I remember what we said about, you know, Baker and the American Werewolf in London. It's like, oh, I didn't like these angles. It's too overlit. But I like that, like, we really saw the werewolf. There's almost, like, to its aesthetic, a little, it feels like, almost like a stop motion maquette in real life. Do you know what I mean?
I think I could see it. Yeah.
The design of it, because it's like you get the full human form. It's not really sort of shaped, and I don't want to say the word is not crude, but the wolf face to me is very interesting, because it's not all like. Because there's like a simplification of it that makes it feel very realistic. A lot of the werewolves that we see have like the snarling teeth and like the eye, and then everything moves. And that's what I mean. It's like there's a static nature that when we're looking at like Harryhausen's work, because the eyes can't blink. You know what I mean? And there's like a simplification of the form and the movement and what it could do because it's suit work. Which is what I like, and makes it look more real.
The suit itself, even the creature, when I watched it again last night, just to get a really good clean on some of my thoughts. But when I think about the creature, when you really see it, especially when you see it in full form, you're really getting a very clear amalgamation of a man and a wolf versus I'm in human form, I'm in wolf form. Right? It's very much the two forms together. And I think that's part of why it looks so unique.
Yes, because that is so cool. So like, if we do like the spectrum of werewolves and wolfmen, it's like he's sort of the transition between wolfman to werewolf, where you do see the man. That is very interesting. That might be a subconscious reaction about why it's good.
Well, and that's when you see how rounded the face is, I think that's why, when I look at it. Versus this very, you know, when you get into American Werewolf in London or even The Howling, where the jaw becomes like very narrow, the cheekbones become very high. With this, and I think you see it most in the regressive transformation scene as the face moves from wolf to man, why the creature ends up looking the way that it does. So, and that's just my take on it.
Because also it's interesting because it's the limits of the technology and the budget and the makeup. But sometimes it's like, that's what I feel in horror. It's like no one has ever watched the Ghoulies movie and go like, they don't move realistically, or I believe that they're little puppets. That's why like horror fans shouldn't be like, I don't like the werewolf in Silver Bullet. It's like, we watch Ghoulies go to college, everybody. Calm down. Calm down.
So critical response wise, and I like to pull these up just to kind of get a sense of what's the overall consensus. But one of my favorite critical responses was a retrospective review that's pretty recent that Felix Vasquez Jr. of Film Threat and Cinema Crazed wrote. He had said that Silver Bullet features one of the best climaxes in a horror film, thanks to director Daniel Attias, and garners a very entertaining and creepy story that develops beyond a typical werewolf movie. When I think of great horror films, when I think of great werewolf films, and when I think of a great King film, I think of this. And I was like, yes, I agree.
He is right. This person is correct in his assessment of Silver Bullet.
Yes. So thank you, Felix. But then when you look at like Rotten Tomatoes, Silver Bullet holds an approval rating of 45% based on 22 critics' reviews. And these are ranging from across reviews that happened in 1985, like with Roger Ebert's review, where he thought it was intended to be a comedy. And if it wasn't intended to be a comedy, he said it was just a bad film. Right. But I'm like, I don't know how you can look at it. Cause to me, there are some lighter moments, but I wouldn't necessarily call it a comedy, because there's also a lot of that. There's some really deep moments in this film.
There is.
And hard moments and touching moments, right?
Yes.
There's adventurous moments, but I wouldn't necessarily say comedy.
I'm flabbergasted because I can't think of how you would contextualize Silver Bullet as a comedy, but it could be the light sort of Americana nature, because its tone doesn't start not it doesn't have a depressing tone. It doesn't have a dark tone. A lot of it takes place in the daylight. It's about a little town. And maybe there is a less sophisticated view on horror back then, that horror could also incorporate this and be in the middle of the day.
I'm sure. I mean, without question, I would.
And sometimes
say, at least answers. From a critical reading.
Yeah,
definitely. But like when we think about the legacy of Silver Bullets, it's interesting because, like I said, I've done a lot of reading. I've done what research I can. But it's hard to find a lot of opinions on things, and I want to know what people think. But what do you think Silver Bullet's legacy is?
Well, I think when you look at Silver Bullet, or the way that I would look at Silver Bullet, I look at within the canon of all the King adaptations. So it's hard for me to just look at it as a singular werewolf entity. It's even hard for me to put it in the sort of werewolf canon because I'm always thinking about it with the text and the adaptation, right? And so I think its legacy, this is me pausing and thinking about its legacy, because it's like, is it a lot of my favorite Stephen King stories? You know what? There's an unpolished nature to its aesthetic, which is probably, and that's like we're encompassing like the wolf suit and everything, what it sort of comes down to. Because I don't necessarily want to use the word low budget, but when we watch something like, you know, Carrie, Christine, even my unsung hero, my love of the dark half, because it's about like a greaser serial killer. And it sort of shows you that that George Stark is far more important than Thad Beaumont, because he's a genre writer in a sense. And almost the read on me is always the opposite. I think that's why it's sort of like forgotten about, because there's not a lot of big names in it. And it's not as polished aesthetically. So I feel all those things work towards it. So there might be a time to revisit it, especially like with now a lot of sort of the not low budget, but like there's a lot of movies that are not in the horror world now that are not based on IP and are not like forced to have stars in them to get them greenlit. And maybe it's time to come back to Silver Bullet. There's a because you know what? There's a humility to the aesthetic of the film. And I feel when contemporary art people watch it, audiences watch it, I don't know if they'll understand that humility, but they might within sort of the lens of sort of the elevated genre space and the more and that sort of like independent handmade film. Because to me, it's much more in line with a lot of like what Glass Eye Picks does and other sort of like more boutique production companies. And Larry Ells always says his work is handmade. So I feel that people want the slickness. Like people want the It movies, like the new It movies. And I feel that they're very slick and very well made, but there's something about the craft and the humility of the one from the 90s that feels a little bit more authentic and real. I think because horror for me, and I'm also a punk rocker, is that I love the punk when you record it on a four track. And to me, the rawness of that nature and those edges that aren't very shiny are sort of paramount to that sound. Now, through the 90s, there's been other labels and stuff like that go and overmix and things like that and make it very sleek. And it's never worked for me. But when you would see those bands off the label live, there you would get the... there you get the recording, because the four track recordings are pretty much listening to live recordings of the band that they just sort of like put on an album. And I think that's why I have affection for it as well, because I don't need this high level of polish. And I always feel like all my goth industrial friends listen to my music and they always want beautiful, high polished music, very produced music. And I'm here with my punk rock on four tracks. And people go like, why do you listen to all your music on YouTube? Because there's not like a lot of high fidelity to what I'm listening to. And then they hear what I'm listening to and they go like, I get it.
It makes sense. And I think when you look at something like Silver Bullet, in a sense, I don't know. When you think about, like you're talking about, a lot of the films that are just these really great indie horror films with budgets that aren't super big, but people do some really amazing things with the visual effects. And a lot of things by hand and practical effects and makeup and things like that. I like that stuff. That's stuff I want to see. polish and things that are sleeker are great still also, but I think that's why certain films are my favorites, right? So, and I don't know what it is. We all have our different aesthetics that we lean towards.
Because I do love studio horror. Like, I love all kinds of horror, right? And I love Blumhouse stuff. I love super slick stuff. Like, I went to go see the It film, but I also have, but it's like, and also, like, I also have a place, because my favorite werewolf movie is The Howling, and I love those werewolves, and if I was a werewolf, like, that is hopefully the aesthetic that I would have, is to look cool like that.
Yeah, like, my other favorite film is The Thing. So,
discs I worked on. Very nice. Yes. Well, anyone who's doing archiving work is a lot like The Thing, because we have to go and absorb everything, and then we become the I have to every title that I've done, I've had to absorb that knowledge, and now it is a part of me.
So I'm going to jump into us talking a little bit about the film and our favorite scenes. There's just so many. I mean, watching it last night, I was like, how can I choose? But big standouts are obviously the werewolf congregation scene. The regressive transformation scene, which I think is fantastic. There's a lot of small transformation scenes throughout the film where it's just light touches, like just the teeth, just a little bit of hair on the face, just the eyes, just the hands. And then there's like fuller ones. But the werewolf congregation scene is just this total chaos type of moment in the film that's like a fever dream, right?
And it gives us a lot of monsters, which is interesting.
It does. It's great. It's just it's like monster prom at church. So,
so good. I mean, you'd hope that there would be, because it's like, to talk about like text the text of Stephen King's work. It's like Salem's Lot gives you the vampire town, and here is like just a taste of a werewolf town, right?
Yeah.
And small town America, not like out in the woods like the Howling. Also, as you were talking, there's a very cool scene where it makes sense, because we could say it's like the small town people, but what really are they in a universal monster sense? There's the villagers, right? So it's the villagers, yes, are out in the fog, and somebody
love that scene
underneath like Jaws. Is really cool.
So this particular villager, I don't know his name off the top of my head, but he's saying he's starting, his voice is starting to crack. His anxiety is very evident. It's under the fog. It's here with us. And then he gets taken down, pops back up. Half his face is like basically melting off from a werewolf swiping at the side of his face and things like that. That's probably one of the more gruesome deaths in the fog scene, and it's like only a couple of moments too. It's not anything super over the top, but it's still a little ooey gooey, and then they disperse. Yeah.
And that whole scene, we get one of my favorite things in all of cinema, which is how many character actors are in this movie and how to do
so many
on its show.
There's a lot of great talent in this film,
right? Lawrence Tierney's in this movie. So the idea that anyone would give it anything, you know, below 5 stars is ridiculous. Because you have him, you have Terry O'Quinn, you have Kent Broadhurst. There's just, I love that. Which is something I also love about The Howling, is that you have all your favorites in there. And that's what makes it magical too.
Yeah. And I think it's fun looking back. You look at Terry O'Quinn before The Stepfather, yes, right? And there's, I mean, a lot of them are so recognizable when you watch it and you're like, wait, who is that? I recognize them by their face, yes, but not necessarily, don't necessarily know their name. And that's the sign of a great character.
Cause we also didn't watch it when it first came out. So we watched these movies with the history of all the things we watched that they were in.
Right.
You know, we've already watched Reservoir Dogs. We've already watched Stepfather movies.
If you watch this now, having the knowledge of lots of other, I think, werewolf films that you've seen, I think you could still really enjoy it. And one thing I tell people is, if you're going to sit down and watch a film, don't go in ready to compare it to everything else. Like, that's not how you should be engaging with this. You're not going to enjoy it immediately.
Well, I think what sort of like I'm sort of talking about, maybe what you're talking about too is that Silver Bullet has a tone that none of the other Stephen King adaptations have. Because I think that's sort of what all we're right. sort of getting at is the tone of the movie, which is not necessarily what the wolf suit looks like or what the movie's about. It's just sort of this mm-hmm. this feel like I've always felt like this is the 1-to-1 ratio of reading Stephen King and watching Stephen King, better or for worse. Like, I feel like this is King.
Well, for the werewolf congregation scene, I wanted to jump over to an article that Paul Farrell wrote called A Congregation of Werewolves in Silver Bullet, and it summarizes Reverend Lowe's wolfed out fever dream, and he states that watching Reverend Lowe once again warily address his flock only to find them turn on him, on God, and it would seem on humanity itself, is one of the most powerful sequences in the film. Not only does it stand as a showcase for the practical effects the film employs, but it serves as a turning point in the story, representing the change that is occurring in the previously calm and loving community, while foreshadowing the true identity of the beast who's been amongst them all along. I thought that was really well put and an interesting way to talk about it. But he also says that Stephen King's words on the page are matter of fact. And so he's referring to Cycle of the Werewolf, the text here. And then they're direct and powerful in their simplicity, all of which carried through to the screen. And the process of transformation is a theme which resonates throughout the entirety of the film. And here it is at its most potent. As the scene on the page devolves into chaos, so too does the screen, with Dan Attias's adopting an almost Creepshow-esque style unique to the sequence. So I thought that was well put in terms of how the scene kind of devolves into chaos. There's so many great, I think they said that they had hired, how many was it? 70 extras divided up into 4 different groups in various levels of makeup and costume for this sequence. And the scene is like maybe 3 to 5 minutes in the film. And then you have your key principal actors as well, about 10 of them, whose looks are also progressing throughout the scene. But it's still one of my favorites. And because I was a child, the first time I saw it, and I was a child that was forced to go to church very often, this idea of a church of people erupting into a congregation of werewolves scared the shit out of me.
So you weren't hoping that everyone was just a werewolf?
I mean, this was the first horror film I'd ever seen. So at first I was like, holy shit. But also I was doing a lot of questioning of like, I don't really understand a lot of what people are telling me about God and church and being here and these things I'm having to do. So at the same time, I was like, is this what's really happening under the surface of this place that I have to go to?
All what religion has done to society, yes. I mean,
yeah. Correct. So I was like, wow. So now when I look back at it, I'm like, oh, there's the whole sequence, even though it might just seem like this really over the top thing, it's saying a lot that I don't think everyone's going to pick up on. Either it's going to be, oh man, this is so cool, look at all these werewolves, or like, I can see the bigger meaning here.
Well, everyone pretends that they're a good person. But I think, but everyone is flawed, and everyone is a wolf, sort of like in a bigger existential sense, if we even look above the religious metaphor and above the small town America has this sort of wickedness, blue velvet metaphor. And our good reverend should accept, if we all look at this as metaphor, his human nature. And I think religion, and again, I was raised Catholic, so there's sort of like this sanctity, sacredness that you're supposed to be, this sort of like perfect gilded nature, which is sort of against the nature and against how the human is, because the human has violence and desires, and it is not a perfect town, but it also could never be a perfect town, and religion can't bring it, or anything can't bring it, because that's also a part of humanity.
Yeah, I think perhaps it was meant to just showcase how there's a lot of imperfections about this congregation of people.
You can't, but I think it's sort of like that's the almost like the highest reading of it, because I think within the story,
probably
you could say that the this is why I like this film is great, because there's multiple readings, because like at the very sort of like narrative reading is that I think that the creature, the Reverend, knows that he's in danger. Because what happens in all these movies, and particularly Frankenstein, is that you have a monster and then the villagers kill the monster. So you must, and you must sort of become the thing that you're going to go and destroy. And he might be scared of that. Like that could be, and this, it could wreck, just like at the narrative level, be his paranoia that they're going to come for him. And not that the whole world is filled with werewolves. It's a possible read.
I think that the, there's a couple scenes that I really like in this. That one's great. Obviously, I think a lot of people talk about that. It's not one of my favorite scenes, but I think it's a great scene. That regressive transformation scene and the music over that scene is one of my favorites. After, you know, it's sort of like we've defeated the monster, but really he's just a man. It's sort of the thing happening there. But the way that it was done, it holds up so well and it still looks so good. And I still, when I watch just the little hairs all over Reverend Lowe's chest start to recede from being a werewolf to a man, it still looks really, really, really good. And there's, of course, one last little jump scare that happens there as well that is still fun. And,
I love a jump scare. That's another thing.
It's a good moment. It's like the last big one in the
people
film.
Who critique that. I will always, like, I will watch the hardest of hard films, but if anything has a jump scare, it will always get me. I will always be gotten by a
it's
jump
still
scare.
Really
it's
good.
True.
And I love the way that scene starts set up. Well, it happens on Halloween, so you can watch this as a Halloween film. The final sequence in the film, it's Halloween night, and everyone's fallen asleep in the living room. The wolf arrives near 3 a.m. And what's so interesting, I love how much of his human nature is retained while he's in wolf form. He's sneaking up on the house. You see his hand moving very kind of sinisterly up against the panels of, or I guess the walls of the house outside, and then cuts the power, right? Diabolical.
Yes.
And before smashing through the wall and, you know, trying to have that element of surprise. And it's really cool the way that Gary Busey's character, he's standing there against that wall. They get smashed in, but he's looking out into the hallway, like the foyer, as you'd be going up the stairs, and there's like a mirror, and so it kind of reflects back. And I just like the way that scene is what am I saying the set design for that scene is laid out, and just the whole panic that ensues as Gary Busey's getting the shit kicked out of him while the kids are trying to get the silver bullet out of the grate in the ground. There's a lot of really good tension in that scene, and I do think it's a great climax, like Felix said. And aside from that, I think there's a lot of scenes earlier in the film, too, that are really good. I always got really, even now watching it last night, it was really scary watching Marty shoot off fireworks at the little bridge and having sort of the werewolf lurking off to the sides in the trees and stuff. And I think it also made me scared of, like, because I grew up in the Pacific Northwest, so there's woods everywhere.
Yeah. Well, there's also a realism and a vulnerability to all the characters in the movie, because it's like a lot of times, like when they drop something, it's like, this isn't realistic, but it's almost a little bit like Blue Ruin. It's like no one's ready to like fight werewolves. I feel in a lot of contemporary movies, like people are way too ready to battle the monster. Like, these are just people.
Yeah, everyone at this point, there's
do the best they can.
A Max Brooks zombie survival guide to every creature. we're
yes,
ready.
This came before. This came way before that. Like, nobody knew how to deal with werewolves. Werewolves in the town. How do you discuss it with the other villagers that this is going on? No one's going to believe you. How do you get, you know, the whole sequence of how he was able to get the silver bullet is incredible.
I think next to this, one of my favorite werewolf films might be Werewolves Within. Or at least for the newer ones, because it gave me a lot of those same vibes that I get from Silver Bullet from a small town perspective. It's much sleeker.
But, do you like werewolves as a creature?
I do.
Are they favorites or no?
Yes, they're definitely my favorites. I would put werewolves above vampires, even though I really like
them. I think that like that says a lot about someone, where they go werewolf or vampires. I sometimes quiz people with that and who is the best Dracula. And that's how you know who's going to be friends forever. And I feel like I lean in my life towards
I think that even though I really love Bela Lugosi, that technically Christopher Lee's Dracula.
Agree. Yes. That's the better also, Dracula. Your friends with Near Dark, that's like the grandfather of those kind of characters. Wouldn't be very romantic and goth. That would be like Severn. Mm-hmm. That comes from the
lineage. Yeah, history. And I do love Bill Paxton's vampire in that film. I'm going to go on a tangent, please. But it's just such a great. And I wasn't able to watch Near Dark until last year when it was on Shudder.
So. It's just you couldn't find it available. I know the DVD was on there.
Yeah, I couldn't find a way to watch it.
I had the Twilight covered DVD. Well, I love Severn so much that I think like in 2019 I was Severn for Halloween.
Oh yeah.
I can send you the Instagram posts. I can embody what are some of the like the guy characters that I played? I've embodied Ed Kemper and I can embody Bill Paxton.
Gosh, I'm just thinking, any other scenes for you that are really kind of standouts or ones that you love when you're watching this film?
For me again, it's the tone, and I'm living inside of a Stephen King movie for 90 minutes. So it's not particularly like a scene.
It's so strange how it passes by so fast, but really it is a 90 minute film. It's not a short film, but it can feel like
it. And it does give me the Halloween feels, which is very important.
Yeah.
The autumn, the new and autumn.
I think it's the little bit of adventure for this film is really the silver bullet itself. Not the bullet you shoot. Silver bullet you ride.
Yes.
The wheelchair. Yes. It's like its own character.
And the design of it looks like that Gary Busey would make it for him, you know? That's what I mean. Yeah. Like the nature is not slick. It's like someone sort of like down on their luck uncle would have made this. Which is why it's wonderful.
Yeah.
And it also a little bit looks like a carnival ride. Because of the colors.
A little bit. Which is interesting that you say that, because he gets it after realizing he can't go to the carnival with the fireworks.
Yeah. No, it looks a little bit like
when the whole fireworks scene happens.
It looks like the Scrambler carnival ride. Which is sort of like, which has sort of the those markings on it, or like a roller coaster, like an old roller coaster, but like ye old timey, not great enough. But like when I go to Coney Island and we like I ride the wooden roller coaster and you're like gonna die.
For me, it's the one. It's we used to just call it, and I still just call it. It's the white roller coaster. Because I don't know what the name of it is.
I know what you're talking about. I know the aesthetic.
It's the white roller coaster at the Galt Fair.
Yes.
The big fair in Washington State. And it's like the big roller coaster.
And this movie has that kind of like fair feeling. And maybe you have to.
There's a lot of, if you were riding a roller coaster with this film, you're going to get a lot of gut drops. That feeling in your stomach.
Yes.
And it's interesting because the way this plays out too, there's a lot of big scary stuff that happens, but at the same time, there's people just living their lives in the middle of it.
Yes.
And so you see these very like, well, right now we're not thinking about all this tragedy that happened. We're having a barbecue.
That could be the humor that maybe they were trying to find in it. But to me, that just seems very natural. Especially people at a
certain, it is very at a natural. Certain... Like, we can't spend all of our time focused on all the bad shit that's going on in the world.
Yes, and in a certain economic class, I can't spend that second worrying about everything. You have to just feed your family, go through your life.
That probably goes back to the small town blue-collar feel as well, and why it, I think, resonates still. And me, maybe growing up, maybe because I grew up in I think at the time I saw this, it was three of us living in the really tiny back room in my grandmother's double wide trailer. Like, we
do you see
there was no money.
This is why. So my father was a construction foreman, so I grew up in a very blue collar household, and my mother was a teacher's aide And that is, and I was always surrounded by construction workers and Vietnam vets.
When we had the kids in the neighborhood around, called the mobile home park, right? And then my grandmother, I think in some ways she kind of is like the Busey character for me, and continued to be up through my early 20s when she passed away. That like my grandmother with like the bottle of Canadian Mist hidden under the bed.
I tell the story of my Polish grandmother making like and someone said it's like your grandmother made prison alcohol. Heather, she didn't make brandy. She would take this big glass jar and put sugar and peaches and a balloon on it and put it on the windowsill. And she used to give it to us.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's prison wine, Heather Buckley.
Well, the body count for this film, and I recounted as it happened last night, is 9.
Not too bad.
Yeah. And we start out with the most blue-collar guy of them all, I think Arnie, at the beginning of the film. Who is, I don't know what he's doing. I think he's a railway worker, but he is, he looks down and sees the footprints and says, oh shit. Like, it's like he has this knowingness about what's about to happen to him, right? But nobody realizes what's happened because they assume it's a train accident.
And during sort of like the mist hunting scene, like those characters also seem real because they have their own like shotguns. They have what, like, a small town would have.
They're all very distinct, though, too. They're not just, like, in the way that each of them look and what's going on. And you see some of them later in the film when she's going to collect cans.
It reminds me a little bit about the manhunt scene in Black Christmas.
Come on. I don't know.
Bobby, you're gonna make lemonade in your pants.
I ain't scared. Let's go. Where's it coming from? Over there? No, it's behind us. I told you you couldn't trust this fog.
It's under the fog.
What are you saying?
It's right here with us.
Definitely see its resemblance to the manhunt scene in Black Christmas, also a favorite of mine. But just even listening to it now, it still gives me like chills and anxiety just thinking about it and the fog and that sense of isolation and claustrophobia and the unknown. And it's just an incredible scene. Stephen King ties to a lot of his other work in anything that he does. And what's also interesting for this film, aside from other Stephen King adaptations, is he wrote the screenplay. So maybe that's why it feels the most King and why I think it's one of the best.
Because he's going to really have insights into these types of characters. Well, people who are right. Because I think you have to, like, grow up in a trailer, have construction worker dad, be in contact with, like, going to living in a place where there's fairs and carnivals to understand these type of characters and to sort of like resonate with them and see them, because you don't see them in cinema a lot because they're not very slick. Because I was also thinking about another one of my favorite movies that has all those characters is The Deer Hunter. It is a drama. It is a Vietnam War drama, and they're all blue collar workers from Pittsburgh that get drafted, like in a steel community, and they're all like they all feel like second generation, and it's an incredible look. That the whole beginning of the movie is like this big Eastern European wedding, so that's sort of a movie that I go to as well for those sort of like characters.
Heather, do you have anything else about Silver Bullet that you want to add or talk about or make note of?
There's nothing wrong with this movie. This is an incredible movie. It is the true Stephen King adaptation. And I've watched all of them, and I've read a lot of Stephen King since I was, you know, even Stephen King scary book cover even helped me become the horror fan I am today. But this is a movie that I like to sit down and watch and rewatch. And I feel out of all the King movies, it is Silver Bullet in the Dark Half that I watch a lot, that I rewatch. But anytime it's like, let's put on Silver Bullet, because I want to be in the Stephen King town with the Stephen King characters. That's how they are. They're in this movie.
Well, thank you so much for stopping in to talk about one of my all-time favorite films. And it's, like I said, like, as you know now, it holds a very special place in my heart and always will. And there's no getting away from Silver Bullet for me. It was my introduction to the genre. And it's one I go back to with a great fondness. So, yeah, man, this has been a great conversation. And I hope you'll come back and talk about more films.
Always. This was incredible.